All those people you see leaving are not fleeing the sermon. One of them has had no sleep for the past 48 hours, and Bob and Francis are going to another church to sing. So please don't take their departure as an example that you should follow. The medieval church loved the number seven. So when it drew up a list of the worst sins it could think of, it was inevitable that there would be seven of them. We've talked about six, some of which are sins of the flesh, like gluttony and lust, some of which are sins of the disposition, like envy and greed. We gossip more over the back fence about failures of the flesh. But Jesus apparently felt that the sins of disposition are worse and cause much more harm in the world. So it's appropriate that the church chose pride as the worst of all the seven, the one, in fact, out of which all the others grow, the kind of disposition that puts one at the farthest possible distance from God. One wonderful golden ager in this church told somebody that she sat during the sermon last week and thought, well, I'm okay this morning. I really don't lust much anymore. And then she thought, because she is extremely bright, but he's going to get me next week because the sermon is on pride, and here I am already being proud about not lusting much anymore. She said, I can't win. Well, there is so much that is good about the right kind of pride that we find it a little hard to be serious about the wrong kind. But the wisdom of the church says we should be, and I hope you will be now for a few minutes with me. One afternoon, a couple of thousand years ago, some of Jesus' friends were strolling along with their teacher, and a few of them lagged strategically behind so they could safely whisper about something which the professor would not hear. And that something was not what they would have for lunch or what plans they had for enriching their ministry, but an argument over which one of them would have the top spot in the coming kingdom. It must have been an ongoing argument, because on another day, the mother of two of those disciples came and begged Jesus to grant each one of them a special place of honor. These two moments are about as sad and disillusioning as anything you can read about in the life of Christ. How terribly disappointing it must have been to find how completely his inner circle of friends misunderstood him and what he stood for. How far that mother missed the mark. I suppose her two boys and the others got a little heated on that day when they fell behind Jesus to argue, and he overheard them. So he stopped the procession, called a little child who was playing by the roadside, put the child in the midst of a little circle of himself and his friends, and said something like this: Who is the greatest in the kingdom, gentlemen? Well, I have an answer for you. The one who is most like this child. Now, we love to tell this story, to paint it, and write songs about it, but I think we do not believe it. Ask any one of us who are the greatest people in our city, and our mind will turn at once to thoughts of money, prestige, conquest. These are the accoutrements of greatness. But not with Jesus of Nazareth. He found it in people who were childlike. And if we sought it where he did, our search would take us to people almost always overlooked, people with none of the usual claims to greatness, people who are candid and without pretense, people who are given to simple honesty and kindness, people who are unskilled in the ways of deception, people who are, above all else, free of that consuming sickness to which we often give the name pride. And so we've come at last to what everybody agreed was the deadliest of all the seven deadly sins. C.S. Lewis, that brilliant Oxford professor who knew the Middle Ages and Christian ethics so well, makes the point like this. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all that are mere flea bites in comparison with pride. Now, you listened to that with your usual courtesy, but I can't believe it was really convincing to everybody. Because pride simply does not sound that bad to us. In fact, we probably encourage pride more than we discourage it. We would say to C.S. Lewis, yes, but isn't there a legitimate pride which is, in fact, responsible for some of the very best things we do? And the answer is, of course. Without confidence, without a healthy measure of pride, we stop being useful to anybody. We become just a meeting ground for whatever forces happen to play on us. Any parent who has ever said to a desperately shy child, "Have some pride in yourself," knows exactly what I mean. The famous beatitude about the meek may fool us, but the New Testament never promised that the spineless would inherit the earth. The word translated meek is terribly unfortunate. It has in mind only people who are under control. What it really means is strength and passion kept under discipline. The English word meek simply does not work. So when we talk about pride, we face a familiar problem. We need two words, and we have only one. One that stands for two widely different things. On the one hand, pride is a proper self-respect. On the other, it's a swollen arrogance, more deadly than any other character defect we have talked about in these past few weeks. And while your mind is picturing a monstrously swollen ego, let me explain the title. I've often thought that if we could see the spirit of a man inflated with ruinous pride, it would remind us more than anything else of a huge balloon, grotesquely inflated to the point of bursting. An object so big that it can hardly go anywhere without being stuck or bruised or scraped. This is my image of a person sick with too much pride. No matter where she goes, there is never room enough for her ego. A perfectly innocent remark pricks his thin skin. A harmless gesture becomes a personal affront. Events that other people would take as accidental, he is sure were meant on purpose to insult him or to mock him. All of us spend an enormous amount of time thinking about ourselves, And it's only a little step beyond that into the extreme, which is sickness. When one thinks only of himself, measures everybody by herself, asks constantly, how will this affect me? What do they think of me? Why don't people like me? And it's always easier, of course, to diagnose that defect in others than it is to see it as an affliction of our own. There was an eccentric Greek philosopher once who used to act out little parables in order to teach. For example, he climbed a statue in the marketplace one day to beg. And when people asked, "What are you doing?" he said, "I am learning to be refused." He was trying to learn humility, trying to control his pride. But the danger in that sometimes is that a man may suddenly wake up to find out that he is proud of his humility. I can remember as a teenager hearing preachers boast about how humble they were. I mean, they actually told us how humble they were. And that seemed so hilariously ironic to me that I promised myself it was one trick I never wanted to use. One does not profess humility. And sure enough, one day this Greek philosopher, Diogenes, who became proud of his humility, met his match. He went to a party at Plato's house, and when he saw the expensive rugs on which no one was supposed to walk, he deliberately started trampling up and down on them, much to the dismay of Plato's other guests, to whom he explained, "I am trampling on Plato's pride." But Plato won the day by saying quietly, "Yes, but you did it with pride of your own, Diogenes." And he did. And the reminder is good for us that in the very moment when we think we are exposing the pride of another, we may be ignorant of a worse kind in ourselves. I think of a movie called The Master Race that circulated in Georgia during World War II, and of a southern white theater owner who saw it and wrote to the newspaper, "We shall have to bash in the heads of these Nazis until they find out that they are not quite as superior as they think they are." And even as he wrote, black people who came to his theater to buy a ticket were refused admission. He was totally blind to any parallel between what he hated in the Nazis and what was hidden away and disguised in his own heart. Somehow I think most of us can admit to temper or lust or envy or gluttony or almost any of those seven deadly sins more easily than we can admit to egotism. In fact, the very act of admitting to those other defects makes us feel a little proud of how honest we are and makes them seem not so bad in a humble fellow who can confess them. No wonder the Greeks, who thought so clearly about so many things, feared above all else this state of mind that we call pride, false pride, arrogance, egotism. They called it hubris, and because they had noticed how often such proud people come to grief, they thought it must cause even the gods to be angry. The Hebrews said much the same thing. Pride goes before a fall, and a haughty spirit before destruction. What pride does is to transform even virtues into faults. Generosity, for example, is a virtue, but pride can turn it into a self-serving act. The proud man finds a way to let everybody know so that he can be praised for his generosity. And then, loving that praise, he starts looking for ways to appear generous without really being so, to get the delicious praise without the actual sacrifice. According to all the great religious thinkers, we are never in as much danger as we are when we start feeling too proud of ourselves. Even if it's a good deed we are in the midst of doing. I was walking along somewhere this week, thinking about today's sermon, and I suddenly remembered a lesson I was taught once many years ago about the nature of pride. A colleague of mine, a professor in the music department, went away on his vacation. And while he was gone, I noticed that his lawn was getting greatly overgrown. I decided to cut it for him. I had just bought a brand new lawnmower, and I thought, what a fine job this new lawnmower will do on Glenn Fulbright's lawn. And when he comes back, how pleased he's going to be. So I started into mowing, and along about the middle of the job, I got to thinking about what a nice person I was to take time to do this for my friend. You know the feeling, that good wine, warm glow that spreads through the body when you start imagining how nice it will be when your goodness is discovered. Your friend's face lights up. His eyes look at you with new respect. He says, hey, that was really great. And you say, oh, it was nothing. I did it for myself, really. I needed the exercise. And then you quickly change the subject so that not only do you get credit for being a nice guy, but you get credit for modesty. We know how to play the games. Well, that's how I was creating the scene to come. And I was mowing faster and faster as I was carried off on the sweet wings of self-congratulation, paying no attention at all to my business, when all of a sudden I hit something. There was a terrible noise, and the mower shuddered and broke, and everything stopped dead still. I had hit an iron post hidden in the deep grass, and it had bent the shaft and frozen my new mower into a useless piece of junk. That was a long time ago, but I can still remember how sick I felt because money was so scarce. And then I remember how the irony of it all broke through my distress. Right at the moment of my greatest pride in my virtue, I had been knocked flat, as if life were saying to me, look out. Pride is deadly, even when it grows out of a good deed. And yet there have always been people who have gotten rid of foolish pride, even when their successes might have nourished it. One night on a ferry boat, a crowd was shoving to get off. As the boat pulled into the dock at Hoboken, one man was slouched in a corner, had been there for a long time in a drunken sleep, no one paying any mind to him at all except to look at him curiously once in a while and with disgust. But just before the boat docked, an elderly man went over and shook the drunk awake, calling the name of the town into his ear so that he would not miss it. All the rest were too busy or too good to stoop and help a derelict. Thomas Edison was not. How nice to know. It seems to me that a man like that must have seen himself against a background that dwarfed him, that he must have been very often in his life face to face with some standard of excellence that put his own ego to shame. And I suppose this is how the Christian is expected to handle the problem of false pride. She lives her life against the luminous background of a better life. He submits to the image of a man who said, "Why do you call me good? Only one is good." Charles Lamb, a 19th century English author who was definitely not soft-headed, put it this way: if Shakespeare were to come into this room, we would rise to our feet. If Christ were to enter, we would fall on our knees. Nobody ever has to worry about false pride who is on his knees. And that is where we are for an hour each week. When we come into this room, we have to hope that it will be enough and that it will last us through all the rest of the week. Amen.